So the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. That word fire there in the beginning of verse 6 is the same as what he used in verse 5. So he's making these comparisons. We see several of the words repeated in this chapter. We've already mentioned that with some of the words there. And we see that also here when he's mentioning the tongue being itself a fire. And he says a world of iniquity. That particular word, world here, is the word for cosmos. And that's the common word. Well, we speak about the cosmos. We talk about the universe in our language. Well, that's where this word comes from. And so it's a word for this physical world. He says the tongue is a world of iniquity. So we know how small a tongue is, but look at the language or the descriptive terms that he's using for that little member that's in us, that it's itself a fire and a world. But what kind of world? In general, it's not a good world. That's the problem that we have. It's a world of iniquity, he says. What a description of the tongue. A fire, a world of iniquity. That word iniquity, adikia is the Greek word there. That's number 93 in the Strong's Dictionary, if you want that. It means injustice, morally wrongfulness. Well, it's a combination where usually when you see the letter alpha at the beginning of a Greek word, that's the negative particle. So it means not, and then whatever follows. So it's not, and then dikos is the other part of the word, which is the word for unjust. It literally means what is not right. So the iniquity is what is not right. That's the literal meaning, if you get down to the root of it. And that's why very often it's translated, when we see it, it's translated unrighteousness. So iniquity and unrighteousness are the common translations of that particular Greek word. And so he says that the tongue is a world of iniquity. It's a world of unrighteousness. Well, how serious is that? I mean, that's a word that should get our attention. When he says it's a world of iniquity, I mean, we know when we see that word iniquity or unrighteousness, that's obviously something that is not at all good. By definition, that's what it means. But, I mean, how serious is that? How easy would it be to say, well, yeah, I've got problems with my tongue. I say things I shouldn't. But everybody else has problems with that too. And then kind of not really take it that seriously. The devil would like us to view it that way. But since it's such a major problem, common problem, does that make it something that becomes tolerable? What's that? No, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be tolerable in our view. We don't want to rationalize it like that. Did we ever do that as an excuse for something, maybe when we were younger and we maybe did something we shouldn't, and may have used that excuse with one or both of our parents? Well, everybody's doing that. Try to make it, it's so common. What's the big deal? If everybody's doing that and it's common, and then that's a way to make it look like, well, that's really no big deal. I think we've probably all done that, to use that kind of rationalization before. Hopefully we're not doing that still, but we shouldn't. The devil's going to try to get us to do that. What happens as iniquity abounds? It does. It will cause our love for God to grow cold when we're surrounded by that, if we're not on guard against it. So that goes back to what we've studied recently. Does a little leaven leaven the whole lump? And if there's lots of wickedness around, and there are lots of... Well, think about just being around what is common as far as the world of iniquity that the tongue is, and what is... I mean, just most of us here have certainly lived long enough that even ones that are among the younger ones in this room right now, but most of us have lived long enough where we have been able, we should be able to recognize changes that have taken place within society, i.e. within the world, concerning what is... acceptable as use of the tongue, words and things. Does, how can, I mean, can you go anywhere now without people just using awful words? I mean, it's everywhere, and it's awful. It's horrible. It is everywhere, and everybody's doing it. I mean, and things that were... that was not something that was as common or just as widespread. Am I the only one that has the impression that language has coarsened over recent years? I don't think I'm out to lunch on that one. I mean, we can see that, and it's just become more and more common for people to use horrible words, and you, it's just very difficult to get away from it at all. And that's just one one mention of it. And what about what's the common view of using the tongue to tell lies? Is lying really considered a major problem? Everybody does that, right? Everybody tells lies. Just using all these different ways in which the tongue is a world of iniquity. Point is, it's something that is becoming even worse. That iniquity is abounding. It's getting worse. What is considered to be common, as far as the misuse of the tongue, as God would describe it, it's becoming a lot more common and worse by the day, seemingly. The fact that that's the direction of things, does that make us look at, become more tolerant of it, or in our view of it, that that's really not that big a deal? That better not be our view. Okay, let's consider the most, if you think of the most extreme example. The whole world lies in wickedness. That's 1 John 5:19. Is there ever a moment, is there ever a time that, are we going to live through any time where that's not true? No. Now, does that mean that the degrees of wickedness, that it always stays the same? Or can times become more perilous, and can iniquity abound? I mean, the Lord warns us about that. Things can get worse, and they tend to do that until usually something major happens to where there's a type of course correction. Sometimes God does very major things in this world and will cause changes when things get to a certain level. Well, what's the most extreme example of that we know of? At what time in history would we consider to be where the whole world was in wickedness to the most extreme that there's ever been. Yep, the days of Noah. And God did something real big then, didn't he? So if there was ever a time for us to think, well, okay, if everybody's doing it and it just gets worse and worse, that God will become more tolerant of that evil. And if people want to think of it like that, that might be the way God would view things, that he would lower his standards or become more tolerant of evil as it becomes more common. Well, is that the case, or is it the opposite? When things get worse, does God change his standards and judge differently about things? Or did God become more angry at all of that wickedness and then pour out his wrath on it? We know what happened. And why did he tell us about that? What about Sodom and Gomorrah? There are plenty of other examples of that. How many... God was willing... The way people would view it, they might expect Genesis chapter 18 to contain some dialogue or a bargaining where, okay, if everybody's doing that, I'm not going to destroy it since it's all of them. And some people would be thinking or expecting perhaps that the Lord would spare them, be more willing to spare those cities if there were a smaller number of ones that were righteous. That's not what happened. The Lord was willing to spare them if they could find... He was going to destroy those cities. Abraham pled with him to spare them if a certain number of righteous could be found. The Lord would not go below what number with Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the plains? He wouldn't go below 10. And when there weren't 10, did he say, well, since there's only... How many came out of Sodom and Gomorrah alive? It's kind of a trick question. Was it 3 or 4? It was 4 that quickly got reduced to 3, yes. I mean, it was Lot, his wife, and their 2 daughters. 2 of their daughters. Those weren't all their children by any means. They lost all the rest of their children and their families. And, of course, we know what happened to Lot's wife. She did make it out of the cities, but looked back and was turned to the pillar of salt. So in one sense, technically 4 got out, but then one whose heart was still there perished. So only 3 survived at all. That wasn't 10. And since the number was smaller, God wouldn't spare them. And when he talks about both those events in 2 Peter chapter 2, when he mentions the flood there and also Sodom and Gomorrah, he brings up those 2 events there. And why does he bring them up? He says it's an example to the ungodly. And then he gets to 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, where he says that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation, but reserves the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. That's the point of it. It's an object lesson for everybody to look at to remember how the Lord will deliver the righteous, in that case the family of Noah and Lot, but that he's going to reserve the unrighteous to be punished, like he did with the whole world in Noah's time, and with those cities of the plains there in Lot's time. So the more wicked the world gets, God doesn't lower his standards or become more tolerant of it. Well, let's look at some scriptures just to make sure that we understand when he's talking about the tongue being a world of iniquity, just how bad that is. Okay, so in Well, when we look at the description in John chapter 7 and verse 18, what do we know about Christ? John chapter 7 and verse 18. And his heart, his nature. Jesus said, "He that speaketh of himself seeketh his own glory, but he that seeketh his glory that sent him, the same is true, and no unrighteousness is in him." And that's that same word, adikia, that is in James 3, verse 6, that the tongue is a world of iniquity. There's that same word there, but it's translated unrighteousness. But what does it say about Christ? He's referring to himself, obviously, the one who was seeking the glory of the one who sent him, not his own glory. Was there any unrighteousness in Christ? No, there was not, very obviously. And then also about God himself in Romans 9:14, it says the same thing, that there's no unrighteousness in him. I mean, there is none with God, and that's with the Father and the Son. I mean, that's who we are seeking to be like. So how can we have a member in us that's a world of iniquity when there's no iniquity or unrighteousness in the Father and the Son? If we're going to be like Christ, we got to do something about that world of iniquity that's in our mouths. That should get us started to consider or be aware of how important our work is on our tongues. Well, 1 John chapter 5, verse 17, he makes a statement about using the same word for iniquity there. But 1 John 5, verse 17 says, "All unrighteousness," and that's that same word, adikia, "but all unrighteousness is sin." So there's a plain statement about it. If it's not right, well, the same book, chapter 3, verse 4, defines sin as transgression of God's law. Well, if something is not right, which is the word, the meaning of the word, and that's unrighteousness, I mean, that's the best, really the best translation of that word we could have. Not right or unright, unrighteous, which is unright, not right. If it's not right, is it going to transgress God's law? Yes. So he says all unrighteousness is sin. Plain statement about it. There's none in Christ, there's none in God, and all of it is sin. Well, that's a problem if our tongue is a world of that. Next we want to look at what he says about what he's going to do about this. Or let's turn to Romans chapter 6, 12 and 13 to see what we need to do, where we need to go, what we're being called to. Because this is, we can see the description of the tongue, and well, the tongue itself, of course, it's muscle. Is that where the iniquity is? In the muscle fibers that's in the tongue itself? It's in our hearts, as we know. It's from the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. So our tongue is what it's being used to say. Is a reflection of what is in our spiritual hearts. So that's where the real problem is. So we've got work to do in our hearts. If our tongue is a world of iniquity, what does it say about our hearts? And that's where the work needs to be. And this is what he says about it in Romans chapter 6, looking at verses 12 and 13. He says, "Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in the lust thereof. Neither yield your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin, but yield yourselves unto God as those that are alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. Well, that word unrighteousness, there's that same word, adikia, again. But he's talking about how we use our members. Use that same word, melos, that he uses for the tongue. It's a little member. But that member of our bodies, what does he say about all the members of our bodies, which would include the tongue? And we looked at those verses when we were doing a study of that word, looking at that word for members. But this applies to the tongue, obviously. So we are not to yield our members as instruments of unrighteousness. Well, which member is a world of unrighteousness? James 3:6, that's the word he uses describing the tongue. So if there's any member that this principle would apply to first and foremost, I mean, it's our tongues. So should we not yield our tongues as members of, as an instrument of unrighteousness unto sin? We shouldn't do that. So it's a world of iniquity. Is it okay for it to be a world of iniquity? Or does that need to change? He says to yield ourselves unto God and our members, including our tongues, as instruments of righteousness unto God. Is it possible for our tongue to become an instrument of righteousness? Can it change from being a fire in a world of iniquity to being an instrument of righteousness? It can. That's the process of our tongue becoming bridled, which is the work that James 3 is teaching us about. But we see the principle here in Romans 6, 12 and 13 also. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. Says, nevertheless, the foundation of God standeth sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity. There's that same word, adikia, again. What are we supposed to do with that? Depart from it. Well, what about our tongue, which is that world of iniquity? Does that still apply? Just like we saw in Romans 6, 12, and 13. We need to go from yielding our members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin to yield them to God as instruments of righteousness for Him. So we need to, do we name the name of Christ? If we're called by His name and there's no unrighteousness in Him by whose name we're called, how can we go along and have unrighteousness in us? Don't we need to depart from that iniquity so that we can be like the one in whom there is no unrighteousness? That's the principle there. What is the nature when he says that there's no unrighteousness in Christ? There's no iniquity there. What is there? He's not an empty, but he's also not a mixture of that good and evil, or as we're going to see the terms in James 3 about our tongue, the sweet water and the bitter. It was not a mixture there. There was no unrighteousness. There is no unrighteousness in him, but what is in him? What is his nature? God is what? He's love. And of course, that word that summarizes His nature is a word that represents many parts. It contains many parts. God's love has many parts to it. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 6, this chapter that is well known for being on the subject of the love of God, at least part of it is, directly. But when he's speaking about God's love, what does he say about it in verse 6? 1 Corinthians 13:6. He says, rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Adikia is used again right there. But God's love does not rejoice in iniquity. There is no unrighteousness in him. And his love rejoices not in unrighteousness. Well, is God going to... What would be his view of our tongues as a world of unrighteousness? That would be something that would be very displeasing to him, most definitely. He teaches us to depart from iniquity, and as we are, until we do that, if our tongues are a world of iniquity, and what is God's view of unrighteousness, of iniquity? Romans 1:18, there's a plain statement about that. It's stating what we were already talking about and explains why God did what he did to the world in Noah's time and to Sodom and Gomorrah, and which just serves as warnings of the judgment to come. Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Adikia is the word there again for unrighteousness. But what's God's view of unrighteousness? And if our tongue is a world of it, what happens? The more iniquity we're involved in, the more that's in our hearts and the more that's coming out of our tongues, out of our mouths via our tongues, means we're going to incur more of what? God's wrath. So he's not going to become numb to our evil and then shrug it off if that's what everybody is doing. That's not what God does. He's going to become more angry. Ultimately, that anger is going to be poured out in the judgment. We're going to be before him in judgment day. And we have already read Matthew 12. We're going to give account that day. I mean, when he's teaching about that in Matthew 12, by what are we going to be justified and by what are we going to be condemned? Our words. So how we use our tongues. Now, aren't we going to give account for all of our deeds before him? Yes. But which part of us is going to play the major role there? I mean, that's another time where he's calling attention to that. Which member of us is the most likely to send us to hell? You remember back in high school, they would have like most likely to whatever. You know, they give those superlatives out when you're about to graduate or whatever. But if we were going to look at our members and say which one is most likely to send me to hell, what are we going to recognize as the truth of that? Our tongues. And that's where so much of our work needs to be. Of course, that work is to be in our hearts, which is where the words come from. But that's the part of us that's going to have such a great impact on our judgment and where we end up spending eternity. And we can see that principle there in Romans 1:18 to explain why. Of course, in Romans 2 in verse 8, God brings it home to that point. So he made his statement in Romans 1:18 about his wrath being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. In verse 8 of chapter 2, he says, "But unto them that are contentious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that doeth evil, of the Jew first and also of the Gentile." He's talking there about the the righteous judgment of God, as he the phrase he uses in verse 5 there, how we're going to be judged in the end, where we're going to be spending our eternity. And if we obey unrighteousness, and which part of us is going to be the most obedient to unrighteousness, which is that world of unrighteousness? Our tongues. What happens if that's what we are? We can see where we get to spend our eternity, which is also going to be the word he's going to use in the end of James 3 and verse 6. And that would be hell. That's where we're going to go if we don't depart from that iniquity, and if we don't bridle our tongues. So these verses, as applied to the tongue, should certainly get our attention and be very concerning to us, so that we do something about this while we have the opportunity to do so. Luke chapter 13, verses 23 through 30 there. And this should help us to understand why Jesus answered the question he was asked here in verse 23 the way he does. Luke 13 and verse 23, the question that was asked of Christ. Then said one unto him, Lord, are there few that be saved? How many are going to heaven? Is everybody going to heaven? Not according to the answer that Jesus gives. Now, if you go to a funeral on earth, you would have an entirely opposite viewpoint. You can pretty much go to any funeral any time, and you'd come away with the conclusion, if somebody asked the question, are there few to be saved? Well, yeah, obviously everybody is. Just go to the funeral and find out. But that's whose judgment. And it's very, people get, obviously, they're, when we lose loved ones, and nobody wants to think about someone that they've loved dearly, and to contemplate that they may lose their souls. Now, we're not the judge of that either way. God is. But God, of course, tells us by what he judges. So it's not like we don't know what the principles are and the standards. But when we look at, people very often talk about their different loved ones that gone on before and things, and they'll be very sentimental about it and talk about how they're looking down on, a lot of times people talk about there's whatever their relative they've lost, and how they're even describing them as being involved in things that are going on now, and people imagine all this, but for us to imagine it, wish it, say it, does any of that make it to be the case? Can we imagine somebody into heaven? I'm not asking, can people imagine that somebody is in heaven? That's what, yes, they do that all the time. But can we, with our imaginations, get someone into heaven? If we just imagine it well enough, or if we wish it hard enough, can then we make it happen? Or if we say it as forcefully as we can, does that make it happen? Another way of asking the question is, what power do we have to send anyone to heaven? Well, the only power we're going to have is whatever we're doing about ourselves right now, but that's it. But as far as anybody else, I mean, what can we do to make somebody go to heaven? And we can try to teach somebody, encourage them, or whatever, but can we make anybody? It's very hard to get ourselves there. But we can't get somebody else there. And we can't imagine it, wish it to be so. The actual fact is, well, Jesus was asked the question, are there few that be saved? And the answer is yes, there are very few. So what men think, that virtually everybody's going to go to heaven, is not the case. And this is in here for a reason. Because when we read these words that follow, now what can we do either way about anybody that's already dead and gone? What can we do to affect their eternity? Not a thing. What's the point of... Are we going to reject what Jesus says because we don't like what that does to what we imagine or what we would like or wish it to be for somebody? I mean, that would be... How foolish would that be? With something that we can't even control anyway. We need to read what Jesus says, accept the truth of it, but most importantly, recognize the application not to people that are dead and gone, but to whom? We need to think about as this applies to us. Verse 24, when he was asked that question, Jesus said, strive to enter in. Now, he doesn't answer this with a yes, there are few that be saved. His answer is a yes, but it's a lengthy yes. It says, strive to enter in at the straight gate. For many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in and shall not be able. Who wants to go to heaven? And he's talking about more than just a wish here. How many people are doing something that at least by their thinking or their wisdom is going to help them get to heaven? Yeah, and that's what he says. And I mean, and there, how many religious people are there? I mean, that number's shrinking, but I mean, there, most people are religious to some degree, and most people have some standard and things that they at least will try to live up to as a standard, things in their mind that, okay, you here's certain lines you don't cross, or here's certain things you should do or shouldn't do, and most people are going to follow some kind of moral code that they think is going to help them to get to heaven. Now, doesn't he say, if you seek, you'll find? This is not a contradiction to that principle. Yes, he does say that, Matthew 7, 7 and 8. So when he says many that will seek to enter in and not be able, that doesn't contradict that he says, if we seek, we'll find. Here he's talking, it's talking about two kinds of seeking, obviously. Is there more than one way to seek? Yeah. Like he says in 2 Timothy 2, in verses 3 and 4 about those who strive for masteries are not going to be crowned except a man strive lawfully. You got to follow the rules. So you might seek to enter in, but if we're seeking to enter in according to our own understanding, according to our own wisdom, according to our own righteousness, according to the doctrines of men, which is what most people do, and the Pharisees themselves did that, the ones who were asking the very question here, that's what most of them do. They were going about to establish their own righteousness, and they were teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. So were the Pharisees religious? Very much so. Did they have a zeal for God? Yep. Did they live by certain teachings and principles? Yes. But whose were they? It was theirs. So were they seeking to enter in? They were, but were they seeking lawfully? Were they seeking properly as God teaches us to. Now, if we seek His way, the way He teaches us to, are we going to find? Are we going to seek and then not be able to enter if we seek the right way with the right diligence? No, then those are the few who will be saved. But there are many that are seeking to enter in, but they're not seeking lawfully or rightfully. And just doing something to get to heaven is not going to get somebody to heaven. And so in verse 25, he says, "When once the master of the house has risen up and has shut to the door, and you begin to stand without and to knock at the door, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open unto us,' and he shall answer and say unto you, 'I know not whence you are.' Then shall you begin to say, 'We have eaten and drunk in thy presence, and thou hast taught in our streets.'" Are there going to be some? How many people are going to be? And this would be it's a very sad thought, a very sad fact. But how many multitudes did Jesus see in his lifetime and in the 3 years of his ministry? How many people actually saw him, heard the Son of God? Saw and heard him in the flesh, heard his teachings, but then didn't follow them. And they're going to have all eternity to reflect on that. That there they were, right in his presence, could hear him, but they rejected it and didn't follow him. And they'll lose their souls. And he says they're going to be saying that we've eaten and drunk in your presence, and you've taught in our streets. We were with you. The fact that they ate with him or drank with him or heard him teach, is that going to get them to heaven? But he shall say, "I tell you, I know you not whence you are. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity." All you workers of iniquity. Adikia again is the word. What's going to happen to all workers of iniquity or unrighteousness? He's not going to have them in his presence for eternity. So if our tongue is a world of iniquity and stays that way, are we going to be in heaven? No. And he says, "There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth when you shall see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves thrust out." How close were they? And he says, "And they shall come from the east and from the west and from the north and from the south and sit down in the kingdom of God, and shall sit down in the kingdom of God. And behold, their last which shall be first, and their first which shall be last." All right, now let's get on really make it hurt. How close are we? I mean, are we going to be saying, "But Lord, I mean, I was in the Church of Christ. I was taught that with my parents. I was brought up that way, and this is what, and I was there every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and all of this." But if we don't bridle our tongues and our whole body, and what's going to end up happening to us? Do we want to spend our whole lives learning all these things, being here with each other like this, and then miss out because we didn't do what he said we had to do? This should be something painful for us to contemplate. We need to while we can. What good is it going to be if we find out, after we've left this life and we're on the wrong side of the gulf and we can't do a thing about it then, and then we're thinking about how close we came, but then didn't do it? So we can read these words now, recognize how serious this is and how big the job we have to do is, but with the Lord's strength, we can do that. He can form our hearts, purge out the iniquity that's causing our tongues to be a world of iniquity, Form us in righteousness so that we can yield our tongues as a member of righteousness unto God. We can do that through Him. We can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. But now is the time when we can do that. We can't do it after we've left this life if we haven't done it before. Then it's too late. So we need to be aware of this now and how important this is so that we can do this job that He gives us to do. Going back to James 3 and verse 6, so the tongue is among our members, that being a fire, a world of iniquity, that it defileth the whole body. Now that whole body, that's a phrase that he used in verse 2, that if we offend, if we do not cause someone to trip, is the meaning of the word offend, to remind ourselves of that there. In word, he says, then we are the same as a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. And then he used that same phrase in verse 3, that bit in the horse's mouth are able to turn about the whole body. Well, now he uses that term whole body again concerning what the tongues do. Just like the bridle turns the whole body of the horse. So our tongue defiles the whole body. That word defile means to stain or to soil. We saw a form of this, a relative of this word, but it had the negative particle to it in James 1 and verse 27. So it's good to look at that again. It's a form of the same word with the negative particle attached. So if he says it, if it's stained, what's the opposite of being stained? To be unstained. Or as it's translated in James 1:27, unspotted. What is pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father? Well, to visit the widows and fathers in their affliction and to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. Unstained, unblemished. What's Christ's goal for each member? We read this verse last Sunday morning in Ephesians 5:27. What's His goal for the church? Which, if that's His goal for the church as a whole, we know that's His goal for each member of it. It's His goal for me. It's His goal for you. In Ephesians 5:27, it's that He might present it, the church, to Himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish, not having spot, unspotted. So no stain, no blemish. Well, that's what pure religion before God requires. So how blemished should our hearts be? How much blemish, if we've got some blemish in our hearts, some stain, then where's that going to come out? What are the chances that's going to come out of our mouths? Pretty well guaranteed, isn't it? So that's where the work needs to be. But he says it defiles, it stains the whole body, blemishes the whole body. Well, by bridling, if we can bridle it, we can also bridle the whole body. But if we've got that, if there's some blemish in our hearts that's coming out of our tongues, then it's going to blemish the whole thing. So it's not going to be something, well, but I'm doing so well in all these other areas. No, if we've got a problem there, then we've got a problem, a major problem that's going to impact our judgment by God. So in James 3:6, he says it defiles the whole body and sets on fire. Now there's a word, it means to cause a blaze. That word is used twice in the New Testament, both times in James 3, verse 6. So and it's really following along with the verse 5 when he says, "Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindles, how great a forest, that little beginning of a fire, what it kindles and how much it destroys." So he's obviously using that same analogy there when he says that the tongue sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. So that's where this ends up. If we continue, if our tongues remain that world of iniquity, we're going to be defiled, and the course of nature is going to be set ablaze by it, and we're going to ultimately be set ablaze. Where? We'll be in that lake of fire. That word hell, that's the word for Gehenna, which we're about out of time now. Because it's good to understand, sometimes when we read the word hell in our King James Version, it's not always that Greek word Gehenna there. It is, which is 1067 is the Strong's number. Sometimes the word Hades is translated hell, where in Luke 16, the rich man who died and then he lifted up his eyes in hell, he wasn't in Gehenna. That word is the word for Hades, which means the unseen world. Well, he was dead, but where did the dead go when they die before the day of judgment? And Hades is not, it doesn't just have the hot part to it. That's one side. Which, going back to Luke 13, that's the populated side of Hades. So if you like big crowds, well, and you don't mind it being really, really hot, anyway, that sounds a little like India, doesn't it? But it's way more crowded and way hotter. So that's that side of the gulf where the unrighteous go. There's a great gulf that divides it from that side, which is paradise, Abraham's bosom, where the righteous will go. And so it's not just a place of punishment. It's also a place of comfort, depending on whether one is saved or lost. But the ultimate eternal destination for the souls of men is either going to be heaven or hell. And that word hell, that's the word for Gehenna. So that's the word he uses for that, talking about the eternal place, that lake of fire that was made for the devil and his angels, where all the unrighteous will go. But we're out of time, so Lord willing, we'll continue in our study here in James 3. Next Wednesday night. Appreciate everybody being here this evening.